I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Is being Black or Latino bad for your health? If you look at risks for certain acute and chronic diseases, mortality rates, access to care and preventative screening, wait times for treatments, participation in clinical trials, having health insurance, there is a discernible disparity compared to whites. And there are real consequences for individuals and for society as a whole in terms of lost productivity and added health care costs. Our guests have devoted their careers to studying racial disparities in health care, why it persists, and what can be done to change the status quo. And they join us here in our Philadelphia studio, and let me introduce them to you. Edith Mitchell is a clinical professor, medical oncologist at Thomas Jefferson University. She also directs the Center to Eliminate Cancer Disparities at the Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson. She's also the new president of the National Medical Association. It's the largest group representing African-American patients and physicians in the world. And it was actually started when Black doctors were denied membership in the American Medical Association. And she is named the Physician of the Year by the Pennsylvania Breast Cancer Coalition and joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. Good morning.
Good morning to you as well. Also with us is Ana Nunez, and she's a professor of medicine, also director of the Center for Excellence, director of the Women's Health Education Program at Drexel University College of Medicine, also the college's Associate Dean for Urban Health Equity Education and Research, and she's also the 2015 recipient of the Association of American Medical Colleges Herb Nickens Social Justice Award. And Ana Nunez, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Such a pleasure to be with you, Marty.
Well, nice to have you both with us on Radio Times. And if I could begin with you, Edith Mitchell, and even when you look back over the last couple of decades, and we're talking about health disparities in this hour, has there been progress made when you look at health disparities overall between racial groups, between whites and African Americans?
Oh, absolutely. The gap, however, between the two races still exists and has actually increased in size. There has been a lot of medical research over the last 2 to 3 decades, and very important research that has given improvement in survival of individuals in this country significantly. Probably the greatest addition to medical care in this country over the last 50 years has been Medicare. July 30th, 2015 was the 50th birthday of Medicare in this country. And over those years, there's been a 15% improvement in survival of individuals 65 years and older, and certainly an increase to access to medical care. So Medicare has been a tremendous boost to the improvement in survival in this country.
To you, Ana Nunez, picking up on what Edith Mitchell just said there, so health insurance matters. And I was reading for Latinos that Latinos are, if they're people that don't have health insurance, chances are they could be a Latino.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, there's actually really important evidence that there's a number of individuals, both Latino, African-American, and vulnerable populations who, even if they have insurance, they're reticent to get into care because they don't have the money for the co-pays, or they've assumed that they will incur a huge bill that they can't pay, so they don't even engage in the first place and then come in very late, very sick, with usually very poor outcomes.
And is the disparity, picking up on that, is the disparity about race? Is it about income? Is it about language in the case of Latinos?
Yes.
All of that. Wait,
because it's very interesting. A colleague of mine talked about sort of, you know, the world writes upon our bodies. So we're not just individual little entities. And so, you know, if I have a 10th grade boy from Upper Marion and I have a 10th grade boy from Kensington High, they're both in 10th grade and they're both boys. But how their health is, what access they have, you know, what issues in terms of trauma and violence they've been exposed to, they're very, very different. And so I think that it's important in terms of the recognition that there are these different sort of barriers and variables that make it be just not the same for everyone.
Absolutely. And to add to that, for many populations, certainly African-American and Latino are the largest populations, but there are others for whom they have poor access to care. So preventive care is a non-entity. It's
they just
not
don't get
even
it.
There. So consequently, preventive care has contributed significantly to the disparities, but also that becomes a part of the culture of the community because they don't have access to care. So there is the need for coming in only when there is an acute care need.
So when they're really
when they're
sick.
Really sick.
How much is mistrust of the medical system, of hospitals, of doctors, how much is that a factor?
There has been a lot of research indicating that people will seek medical care from individuals who have something in common with them. So many of our institutions don't have anything that they can relate to, that they trust, or that they can communicate with. So communication is a big part of it, whether it's due to language or culture or education. Much of the educational material that we have is printed at a grade level that is above many of the populations. So in addition to language barriers, there is the educational barrier. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to add to that?
I do want to add to that. Yes. There's both sort of the sort of overt and sort of conscious barriers in terms of, am I safe here? Will this person care for me? You know, and there's also sort of unconscious bias. And we all play that game. This is not something that's unique. It's a human experience. And it's sort of the difference between, you know, if you go to a place and they say, can I have a map? And they sort of give you just a little nasty little map that's there, that's kind of tread upon. And then the next person comes and they say, can I have a map? And they give this beautiful photocopied, colored, beautiful map. And, you know, for some people, they get sort of the royal treatment, and some people, they get sort of just, here we go. And I think that that unconscious bias, when you look at the literature, attitudes when it comes on racial times in terms of division, actually isn't shown to be very different than that of the 1930s. We have been better in terms of the overt, sort of saying nasty things, kind of, in some spheres. But certainly in terms of the unconscious bias, sort of the who's mine, who's not mine, who am I safe, and who do I go that extra step for, and who do I not? Those unconscious bias play a huge role.
So it's not sort of the kind of overt racism we might associate with the 1930s, but it's more subtle. It's more
nuanced.
Waiting times, maybe not believing a patient if they tell you something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. I was just talking to a student that was shadowing me in the office, and I said, if you have a patient who takes a medicine and they say, sometimes I need it and sometimes I don't, you know, not on a chronic illness, then you'd say, well, that's a discriminating patient. They're being discerning. But like at the same time, a patient who doesn't use it and sometimes does, well, they could be noncompliant.
Oh.
And so it's the same behavior, but sort of the attributions are very different in terms of, you know, are you allowed to do that or are you not doing what I said in terms of being the bad patient?
And Edith Mitchell, you're saying that we need more African-American doctors, we need more African-American nurses. I mean, just we need more people of color who are in the healthcare professions.
That is always the case. And whether it's African-American, Latino, or other racial minority, I think it's very important to increase the number of individuals who relate to communities, and regardless of the race or ethnic background, it's very important to have physicians who have cultural competence where they can relate to people who may not necessarily look like them or have some of the natural policies, but we have to invite more people. And it's very clear that especially for African-American men, the number of African-American men entering medical school is actually less than it was in 1978.
I saw that.
So there, and a lot of research has centered around this. So it's very important to increase the number of healthcare professionals.
But are you also saying that a white physician or a white nurse, I mean, if they have the kind of sensitivity and training that they can have the kind of relationship with an African-American patient?
Oh, absolutely. And as I said previously, it's very important for the healthcare provider to understand the population that they are providing care for. And it's not just white or black or white and Latino. There are differences between patients in the South and those in the North. So you have to understand the population and the culture of the population. It's even different here in Philadelphia. South Philadelphia is very different from West Philadelphia and North Philadelphia. So it's just really knowing and understanding the population for which we provide care to. It's not necessarily about race. It just happens that there are more minorities and underserved patients who are members of minority populations. But whatever patient care you are providing, you need to know who the patient is.
Yeah, who you're dealing with. Also, I'm wondering about questions like, do you have a refrigerator? I mean, are there certain sort of basic questions that someone might not think to ask?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there are these sort of expectations in terms of, you know, and that sort of actually really was a revelatory thing that I learned in terms of some of the experiential work in the community, that in Philadelphia, there are places that people don't have refrigerators. And I was sort of like, I mean, I'm a bit of a foodie and like to cook, so I can't imagine living without a refrigerator plus stuff in it. But I thought, well, how do you make do? And I thought, well, okay, if you only eat at fast food restaurants, if you have sort of the little, you know, sort of dairy creamer that's non-dairy, that's kind of the powdery stuff, and you never eat fresh fruits or vegetables, and perhaps don't have reliable electricity, I guess you would, you know, and there's a corner store, you could live without a refrigerator. But if I'm taking care of a patient who has diabetes, and I don't know that they don't have a refrigerator, and they feel that refrigerating their medicine is kind of like good to do, but not essential, and here we are trying to get that blood sugar under control, we're going to do this dance for forever, because I don't know the question to ask to get at that they don't even have a refrigerator. And who's going to come in and sort of say, well, I don't have a refrigerator?
Right.
That's, you know, that's not something that somebody's going to feel particularly good about talking about.
Yes, go ahead.
There are also other disparities. It's not just African-American and Latino. Certainly, those are the two largest populations. But for example, LGBT individuals in terms of cancer, that's an underserved population. So that's another. For young individuals who develop adult cancers, that's another disparate population. The aged, our population in the United States is aging tremendously.
Sure.
So that elder care or geriatrics, that's a very disparate population. So our work doesn't cover just Black and Latino or African-American and Latino. It really covers disparities, no matter what the population might be. We also have other immigrants to this country who don't speak English, who don't have access to care. They have no health insurance, and therefore they're underserved. So our work really covers all of the individuals for whom there is underserved health care in America.
Well, let's hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very sharp break, and we are talking about health care disparities in this hour of Radio Times. And as Edith Mitchell just said, talking about it in all its forms. And she is a medical oncologist at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, directs the Center to Eliminate Cancer Disparities at the Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson. Also with us is Ana Nunez, and she is director of the Center of Excellence, director of the Women's Health Education Program at Drexel University's College of Medicine. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the persistence of healthcare disparities, what can be done about it. And our guests are Dr. Edith Mitchell, oncologist at Thomas Jefferson University. She's the new president of the National Medical Association. Ana Nunez, professor of medicine at Drexel University, associate dean of urban health equity, education, and research. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. I see emails coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ana Nunez, you wanted to say something right before the break.
Well, you had mentioned in terms of, you know, how do we all sort of improve in terms of having a cadre of healthcare providers that can do this. And I think that one of the important things is also how we teach about health disparities, because if we teach that here's this sad fact with this population, and you sort of memorize these sad facts and then you accept bad outcomes, that's one thing. Whereas if you sort of teach that we're in this situation where we have to have some initiative in terms of mixing it up and changing it, that isn't indelible deservedly so. And what we do is we sort of blend experiential opportunities with students with the facts, but sort of challenge them as scholars to sort of say, how can we turn this around? How can we do something differently? So we just don't accept that it's just bad, bummer. There's nothing we can do. There really is sort of this is on our to-do list to make a change.
Well, that's interesting because we often think about, you know, teachers' expectations for students. You're talking about doctors' expectations for their parents.
Patients, yes.
For their patients.
Yes, absolutely.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Also, I mean, I don't need to tell you, Edith Mitchell, about how complex our healthcare system is. It seems to me in terms of access and treatment and figuring out how to use the system, I mean, that seems like it's a challenge for everybody these days. And I'm assuming if we're talking about people that maybe don't have health insurance or have waited a while because they don't really know how to access the system, that makes it even tougher.
Very much so. And that's the reason why we try to work with communities. So that we have educational programs with communities in a setting that they are used to dealing with and getting information. So that has contributed significantly to breaking the silos so that patients feel comfortable in asking questions, in realizing that they need preventive care and continuous care.
I was also reading that there are fewer African Americans and Latinos in clinical trials. Why is that significant?
There are a number of reasons. First of all, I'm a provider, so I always look at what the doctor does first. And for many physicians, because of the language barriers, many physicians will not invite minority patients to participate in clinical trials. And there have been excellent research studies that have demonstrated that you have two patients. One is African American, the other is Caucasian, with the same disease process, and they're offered different treatments or different opportunities for participation in clinical trials. So that's one aspect. And of course, trust in the healthcare institution and the providers serves as a big part of clinical trials. The education that goes along with that. We all remember the Tuskegee study, and whether patients verbalize that or not, it's a consideration that they are being invited to be a research guinea pig, and therefore there's no way that they will participate. There's also the community involvement that plays a role. So there are multiple factors contributing to fewer patients being in clinical trials. But what is very clear, we need patients in clinical trials because there are metabolic differences in how the body reacts to medications and handles those medications once they are consumed. So consequently, it's very important.
I just wanted to add, too, that there's work that we have in terms of our outreach for health disparities that actually looks at two variables at the very least called intersectionality, because often your sex and your ethnicity sort of play a role. So adding on to sort of the comments that Edith made, if you have minority status and female, you sort of sail a little bit further down. So if we look in terms of sex and gender differences, there's differences in terms of heart disease and things like that we know, a disease more for men that women die more of. But if you look and you add the ethnic component to it, then the women who are sort of ethnic women die worse, especially African American women, of heart disease. And so there's that element, too, that we have to pay attention to in terms of resources and ability so far as outcomes.
And a different course of treatment? I mean,
absolutely. It's fascinating now that there's actually a male pattern and a female pattern of heart disease. And it turns out that if you have a female pattern of heart disease, it doesn't get diagnosed accurately. You end up having poor outcomes and you die at higher rates. And probably 4 out of 5 women present that way with GI upset and things like that. Interestingly enough, men who present with that female pattern also get not diagnosed. So it's missed because it's just looked like there's one pattern and that's the way we do it. And the disease is actually even different.
Well, Edith Mitchell, I was reading about black women who have been diagnosed with breast cancer, looking at their outcomes, and they don't fare as well as some others.
There's a 15% higher death rate in African-American women with breast cancer, some of which may be related to genetics. For example, the most aggressive form of breast cancer, called triple negative breast cancer, where there is no evidence of the three receptors that we use for guiding medications. This is a very aggressive form of breast cancer. It grows faster, metastasizes to other organs, and patients die of it much earlier. This form of breast cancer is found twice as frequent in African Americans as in Caucasian women, and therefore African American women die of the disease. There's also been research showing that African Americans metabolize some of the drugs that we use for treating breast cancer in a different manner. So consequently, we are learning more about drugs and some of the common drugs that we use for treating patients. So therefore, there are multiple factors, including lack of access to care, funds to come in for frequent visits, more African Americans as well as Latino work in jobs where if they miss a day from work, they miss a day of pay. So consequently, we are now looking at non-medical costs that impact on health care. They may not have the money for a bus ride or to be able to reach the medical institution.
I mean, that's just a very, not to in any way take away from that, that's just a practical problem. If you can't take off from work or you lose money because you need to go have a breast screening, you pay the consequences for that.
Or you don't have anybody to pick up your children from daycare, and so you don't go to your chemotherapy because who's going to pick up your children? You know, the resources to be able to do that and sort of having everybody understand, you know, just because you prescribe something, how you sort of get there sort of has to make a difference in terms of the ability to make it happen.
And do those people then become called a non-compliant
patient? Sure. I mean, there was a patient who said, gee, you must not care about being cured from cancer because you came, you know, you didn't, you know, come on time for your chemotherapy. And she didn't have anybody to pick up her children. And, it's, you know, I mean, so it's things like that in terms of, but it also speaks to the issue in terms of looking at health disparities that we really have to look from the continuum. Because there was a time when it was like, well, breast cancer, more for white women, more black women die, must be access, buses, don't get mammograms, whatever. And fortunately, in terms of that continuum from, you know, sort of sick environment all the way to access, all the way to genetics, the look was, well, actually, in every sort of area, there's sort of something there from sort of genes that may have differences, response to treatment that may have difference, physiology, as well as how you get there, access, and where you came from in terms of your exposures. And so, and when we want to deal with health disparities, we have to look at that whole continuum because there's differences.
And is it also true for prostate cancer in African-American men?
That is true for prostate cancer in African-American men, actually. The disease occurs at a much younger age in African-American men. And with all of the different guidelines for screening, there has been confusion from individuals about the value of screening for prostate cancer. But yes, it can be a very different disease in African-American men compared to others. Another area is multiple myeloma. Oh. Multiple myeloma occurs much more frequently in African American men and women than in any other racial group or ethnic group that we know about.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. We've got a lot of people that want to join the conversation talking about health disparities. And our guests are Dr. Edith Mitchell. She's a clinical professor, medical oncologist at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. She also directs the Center to Eliminate Cancer Disparities at the Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson. And she's the new president of the National Medical Association, representing African-American physicians and their patients. And as she reminded me when she got here, this was an organization started when black doctors were denied membership in the American Medical Association. Also with us is Ana Nunez, professor of medicine, director of the Center of Excellence, and director of the Women's Health Education Program at Drexel University College of Medicine, also the college's associate dean of urban health equity education, and research. And a very credentialed guest, I must say. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me see what Joanna from South Philadelphia has to say. Joanna, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Hi, Dr. Nunez, Dr. Mitchell.
Hi.
I just wanted
Hello.
To, I'm not sure I heard the entire show, but I was wondering if your guests have had the occasion to talk about adverse childhood experiences. The ACER study that was done, I think, back in the late 90s. I'm not sure if you guys spoke about that already, but.
Nope, we haven't, but it's a huge
issue. But it looks like Ana Nunez wants to jump right in on it.
Absolutely. That's a great, thank you for bringing that up, because we talked about sort of lived lives being different. In short, the ACES study was done quite a number of years ago in San Diego in an HMO setting, predominantly white, predominantly college-educated individuals, and looked at categories of sort of violence or trauma that occurred at childhood. And so physical violence, sexual violence, living with someone who'd been incarcerated, mental illness, et cetera. And it basically found that the more of these categories of violence or trauma that you had, the more likely you had in terms of unwanted pregnancies, earlier heart attacks, et cetera. And this was, and again, I remind you, a sort of white college-educated sort of population that we found this, and a number of investigators are looking at more vulnerable population, which we some of us sort of say, do you really need this study, because we know that the numbers are going to be off the charts. But if you have trauma at an early childhood age, at any time, but certainly at early age, you end up sort of being hypervigilant that, you know, every, you know, your blood pressure is a little up, you're stressed out, you're expecting sort of bad, nasty stuff happening because it's happened in your past. And if we are unrecognized in terms of that, that results in sort of poor outcomes. And so figuring out how, with colleagues at Drexel, like Sandy Bloom, who has sort of a whole sanctuary model and an approach about how to help people help themselves in terms of healing from trauma, are incredibly informed. Mm-hmm. In our Philadelphia UGMA, it's a community initiative project. It's both sex and gender and sort of trauma-informed, as we sort of empower individuals within the community in their settings to figure out how can I sort of get to a better place with things. But it's a huge thing that a number of places, Drexel and other sites, are sort of including within the curriculum so that healthcare providers in the future know about it. But it's a really, really important thing about sort of, again, how the world works on our body, you know, in terms of ways that really have adverse outcomes. We don't yet have internists asking about ACEs to patients who are adult patients. I think
that might be interesting, wouldn't it?
But we need to get there.
Yeah.
And it's
and
really
that's
about,
all.
Yes, please.
That's
go ahead.
All a part of the healthcare assessment that we are teaching now, right, is to teach the medical students how to incorporate information from early childhood and how this affects the patient as an adult. So we are teaching it in medical school now.
Also, just underscoring how important these, I guess, life in utero, but also these very early years in a child's health development. I'm looking at you, Edith Mitchell, sort of setting the stage for the future of someone's health.
That's absolutely true. And the environment in early childhood and during maturation certainly can affect one's thoughts and perceptions of medical care.
Joanna, thanks for calling. You tapped into some really good stuff here. Let me see what Anastasia from, looks like Bala Cynwyd has to say. Anastasia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hey. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a medical anthropologist, and I tuned in to hear this fascinating conversation.
Yes.
I'd like to go back to your conversation on cultures, ethnicities, social groups. And I find that a lot of studies focus on the cultural group as the other. They're non-normal, they're an outlier, and maybe they're even stigmatized, and their cultures seem to be part of the problem of their, or is interpreted to be part of the problem of them accessing or not accessing healthcare. And as an anthropologist, I think it's useful to for providers to understand that they also have a culture and that biomedicine has a culture, and that might also play a role in patients accessing care. And I wonder if your two guests
sure.
could comment on that. And I'll take the comments off the air.
Sure, Anastasia, thanks for the call. And this is something we touched earlier, but go ahead.
Absolutely. Delighted to talk about this. Actually, when I did my medical education fellowship about sort of cross-cultural effectiveness, there was very much sort of the other and the deficit, right, in terms of sort of anybody who's not you must be other or sort of different, but not as a positive. And it's incredibly important and certainly what what we teach as far as cross-cultural effectiveness is, you know, be able to look in the mirror and say, who am I and what do I bring to it? Sort of diverse is everybody who's not you and you in terms of that, as well as in medicine especially, we tend to go after disease and dysfunction because that's what we want to cure.
Sure.
And then when we look at patients, the tilt tends to be sort of in the negative. But we really sort of focus in terms of the strength attributes. When we work with members in terms of faith-based community and our Philadelphia Eugene Initiative, the resilience and the support in some of these networks are tremendous. And so being able to identify sort of the strengths and the attributes within the culture, as well as the challenges in terms of sort of a fair approach, and not just say it's sort of one thing monolithically of American culture or medical culture, is incredibly important. I think that the ability to actually look at a person and say, how are we the same and how are we different and holding at the same time, promotes of an empathy of understanding the individuals within the group rather than just creating stereotypes, which we really want to avoid because stereotypes perpetuate health disparities.
Can you do that knowing that so many doctors feel so rushed, you know, trying to see patients and trying to have a relationship with them when they've got, what, 15 minutes?
Medical education and research in medical education now is evaluating and working on how can you incorporate all of this information. Are we using the electronic medical record to help us? So the answer is yes, we have to do that. We are engaged with personalized medicine, though. And personalized medicine involves all of the patient, but it also involves the physician, because as a provider, and this goes for everybody in the medical care arena, it's not just the physician, mm-hmm. but it's the physician staff, the front desk, whoever answers the telephone. All of these people are involved and therefore must understand the patients who they provide care to and must do that in a personalized manner. So all of the components, whether it's the provider and provider staff, the hospital staff, the patient, and those entities that build on the patient. And we find that outcomes are based on that. Mm. And we are now evaluating quality of care. And quality of care involves evaluating the entire patient.
We need to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about healthcare disparities and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Drs. Edith Mitchell and Ana Nunez about healthcare disparities. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And I want to have them share with you what we were just talking about off the air, which are just the subtleties, but the importance of understanding these implicit biases. And Ana Nunez, go ahead.
Sure. We were talking in terms of, you know, how does the healthcare team need to sort of address these? And there is certainly operational things and the quality measures, but also from the unconscious perspective, there are tools online in terms of implicit bias that you can go and take and sort of see which way do you sort of tilt in terms of preferences between black or white, women or men. And those understanding those biases are really important. One colleague actually, when she took the test, was very disappointed because she found out that she actually tilted against African Americans and was just dumbfounded. And so she actually talks about that one of the things she does to get herself into the frame to sort of push the other way is she has images of like Oprah and like all these fabulous, you know, Sotomayor and all these major people that she has on a screen that sort of looks before she goes in to care for patients, because then the image of these awesome minority individuals inspires her to sort of change her headset in a different way. And I think that, you know, overcoming unconscious bias in a conscious way is really important if we're going to mix it up.
Well, Edith Mitchell, you were even talking about how, doctors in training are looking at mannequins or dealing with mannequins.
Yes, simulation is a part of medical education now. And these simulations can occur at medical conventions and we use them in medical schools where there is a mannequin with an abnormality. And you can change the appearance of the mannequin in terms of the color or the size, the gender, and the attire. And interestingly, there's preliminary data to show that obese people are discriminated against, and that the provider's bias for an individual who is obese may be different than if the mannequin is slim. There are differences in terms of the color. So changing the appearance of the mannequin to look like minority populations makes a difference. And interestingly, changing the attire of the mannequin makes a difference. So if the mannequin is well-dressed, well-groomed, and looks really good, the perception and the questions that the medical students ask are very different than if the person is, for example, obese and wearing tattered clothing and not looking so, quote, good.
Well, it's interesting, just these assumptions, stereotypes, how much they can operate in our unconscious and then show up very directly in treatment.
Yeah, there's literature actually that shows that they've done studies having an adolescent African-American male walk down one side of the street and have people walk down the opposite side of the street, or the same side rather. And when they're closing into this adolescent male, people will cross the street because they mm-hmm. don't seem that they're safe. But then they interview those individuals who cross the street, and none of them remember seeing the adolescent boy, and none of them remember crossing to the other side of the street. Yeah. And so I think that it really sort of plays on the only way we can sort of address that unconscious stuff is doing something consciously in terms of seeing it and then acting upon it.
And the same is true of elevators.
Mm-hmm.
There are studies with an African-American male in an elevator, and what happens, people hold their purses tighter mm-hmm. and they move to the other side.
Or maybe don't even get in at all.
Absolutely.
Right.
So there can be bias based on our perception of what the other person looks like.
And don't get me wrong, we're not asking people to be perfect. We're just asking people to sort of be mindful in terms of their actions and their impact to sort of do at least what in their heart they want to do in a conscious way.
And that is true regarding how people see the medical profession. So I was asked once in a hospital if the person thought that I would enjoy working in the kitchen.
Oh, no. Really? Was this recently?
It was a few years ago, but it just shows the bias in that if you see a dark-skinned individual in an institution, they are expected to be mm-hmm. supportive staff, not the professional staff.
Let me read an email from Mac saying, can you ask them if a market-based healthcare reform like the Affordable Care Act helps or worsens health disparities? And I guess the question is, we have had the Affordable Care Act for a couple of years, still in the process of putting it in place. Have you seen, Edith Mitchell, have you seen differences? Have you seen better outcomes or even better care, better access as a result of the Affordable Care Act?
The Affordable Care Act is early in terms of evaluating outcomes. There is more emphasis on processes now, and what are some of the barriers. So some of the early identified barriers include the cost of copays and deductibles, such that, for example, I have a patient who, quote, has insurance, but they have a $5,000 deductible, so the insurance doesn't kick in until they actually pay $5,000 out of pocket. Their total income for the family is probably in the high 30s. Mm. So, you know, you can't pay $5,000 out of that income. So there have been some problems that have been addressed. So in the next market that is coming up soon, there are going to be some differences in terms of that. Mm. But what I have seen is that for individuals who are able to utilize and access the plan, yes, we have some individuals who never had access before that now have access. I have individuals who participated in a cervical cancer and breast cancer screening project where they got free mammograms and pap smears. Now they have insurance, and they're still coming in for those procedures, but able to pay for the procedures themselves. So yes, it has had some impact. Now, if we're talking about improvement in survival, that is going to require a longer period of time to evaluate them.
Right. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly, we have fewer people that who are uninsured. That's great. It is just a first sort of baby step moving forward. I think the other element is if you look in terms of especially small businesses with less than 100 people, that less than one in five actually are going for, on the exchange. And the reason is because writ large, we don't have sort of a living wage. And so if you don't have a living wage, then $150 a month is going to be too much, or $5,000 copay might as well be not having insurance at all. Right. Or, you know, so I think that that's really important, that it is a first step. But we certainly need to make much more sort of inroads so that it is actually achievable that people can have a living wage and have health care as part of it.
So it's all fits together. Yeah. Yes.
And I think our best example of that is Medicare. When Medicare was first organized and initiated in this country, there were many individuals against it. Now, Medicare accounts for approximately 16% of all individuals in the country. So it started out for those over age 65, and then those with disabilities added later, and Medicare continues to change. So I don't think we should see it as fixing the problem on the first day. We've got to take steps. We've got to evaluate the processes and make sure that the processes are working. And that took a while with Medicare. But now we know that Medicare has had a tremendous impact on overall survival in individuals over 65 in this country.
Let me get, looks like Susan from Wallingford to join our conversation. Susan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure. I really appreciate all that you're sharing, especially as it affects social racism and the sensitivity that is required for handling all this material. With over 197 Native American communities being represented within the workforce in Philadelphia 20 years ago, and I doubt that those numbers have decreased, is any attention being paid towards their instances of cancer, heart disease, and especially diabetes, since we seem not to be able to metabolize certain sugars that are in our diet?
Sure, Susan, appreciate the call. Ana Nunez, looks like you want to answer.
Yeah, it's incredibly important, and we certainly know, so far as Native American communities, that there are incredible sort of health hazards, if you will, both for individuals who live on the reservation versus people who live in terms of urban centers. Again, access to resources, environmental exposure. It's interesting in terms of as we've moved to this buzzword of precision medicine, right, so that we can sort of get, you know, all that information, all the genetic information and understanding. And I think that, you know, understanding so far as genetics is a first step. Epigenetics, the environment, that social sort of issues in terms of health is an important piece. But the other element as we move forward in terms of genetic medicine and precision medicine is we have that same, you know, it's my blood and it's my body. What are you doing with the information and researching it? Because there are lots of people who are very interested in getting big data banks of blood from Native American, African American, Latino sort of subcultures, and then saying, now we're going to run all these tests and we're going to find out all these things that are sort of wrong with you folks. And I honestly think that where we need to sort of be mindful in terms of involvement and sort of patient advocacy is joining up and sort of being involved in these data banks, but also being part of the conversation of, oh, you all want to research this, tell me what it is. And the things that I'm interested in, fine, you can sort of work with my genes to find that out. And those other things I don't necessarily want to play. And I think those safeguards are really important for us to get to issues in terms of alcoholism, cancer, diabetes, and hyperlipidemia, and a number of issues that we see both in Native American communities and others. But it's a really important look.
Susan, now, thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead.
I'd like to add to that our efforts now are really toward healthcare equity. So for any individual group where there have been disparities that have been defined, we're interested in working with that. So, for example, I mentioned earlier the aged population. Elder care in this country still has a big problem, and there are disparities. There are racial disparities. Certainly African-American and Latino are the largest populations, but there are others. The Native American population, individuals from Asia that have migrated to the country as adults, language barriers and other problems. Many of these individuals have no insurance and aren't eligible for Medicare or other government-based insurance plans. So we really try to work with a patient on a personalized basis. That personalized basis includes their childhood, their background, and those entities that may be genetically based, as well as those that could be environmentally or culturally based.
Let me read an email from Steve. He says, I live in Reading. I know almost all primary care providers here don't take new Medicaid patients, not Medicare, but Medicaid patients. They say their quotas are reached, so poor families are going to the emergency room. You're rolling your eyes, Ana Nunez. But, you know, this is the system that's set up to help some low-income families. And if people are shutting their doors, what does someone do except go to the ER, which is a very expensive way to get your care, and you're not going to get your cancer care in the ER.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I think the system is in need of change so that we can have sort of baseline health care for individuals so that we can attend to sort of elements rather than sort of, hey, well, you know, if I have to pay my front desk person and I take all these Medicaid patients, I can't pay the bills, et cetera. We have to move from a fee-for-service perspective to sort of coverage in terms of individuals and populations so that we can have sort of our reimbursement reinforce the opportunity in terms of healthcare. I was going to make the comment that sometimes the word equity and equal get confused, and people think equity is sort of the same as equal. And the analogy I use is if healthcare is sort of our goal and we have some hurdles here and we have four children and one is able-bodied and the other is in a cast and another is in a wheelchair, if we want equity, we want them all to get to that end point where they have sort of good care. But they're going to get through it differently. And so it's not necessarily going to be equal how that process is. And we have to consider that if we really want to have the end goal of having good health care for all, which actually is cost effective and important for us as a country.
I actually wanted to ask a question about organ donation, a little bit of an odd segue here, but I'm looking at the clock here, and my understanding for certain racial groups, you know, they're suspicious about organ donation. They don't want to give a kidney or another organ for somebody else for fear that they might not get the kind of care that they deserve. How big a problem is that?
Well, it's a big problem in that many individuals don't understand organ donation. And there have been episodes that have occurred. In fact, I'm working with someone now based on the fact that they granted an autopsy. And they were told that when the remains reached the funeral home, there was not their perception of what they had signed for. So these stories actually move through the community very quickly, and you will find that there is a reluctance for many procedures after death. That includes organ donation as well as autopsies and other after-death procedures. And there is also the perception that if there is a request for a kidney donation, that the person who is asking for this is really looking for the kidney and therefore is not focused on the individual who is donating that organ. And it can go for other organs as well. So, again, it's the medical community working with the patient population for whom they provide care to, and after-death care is really very important.
There's gender differences, actually. In the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, more women sign up as organ donors compared to their male counterparts.
Ah, just to add to the wrinkle. Well, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. I feel like we just skimmed the surface here. Edith Mitchell has a number of credentials here. I'll just say that she was named Physician of the Year by the Pennsylvania Breast Cancer Coalition. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. And Ana Nunez is the 2015 recipient of the Association of American Medical Colleges Herb Nickens Social Justice Award. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.